Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio, where we bring you information about Minnesota's National Guard, the military community, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon Program, and Department of Veterans Affairs. Your host is Tom Lyons, founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a Twin Cities merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is also a Vietnam veteran of the United States Air Force and a member of the VFW and American Legion. Now, here's Tom Lyons.
Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. On today's show, we mark the 40th anniversary of the return of our Vietnam prisoners of war, and we have a special guest, General John Vesey, joins us to discuss his work in recovering our troops missing in action. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Rick Nash.
Since the Revolutionary War, and every conflict since, Black service members have not only answered the call to serve, but have lifted the Star-Spangled Banner to great heights. Our flag is not one color, though the threads are made of the same fibers. Different colors intertwine to create a bold, vibrant symbol of inspiration for our nation. The Minnesota National Guard is much the same. The Guard finds its strength not only in its diversity, but in its ability to weave together people of different faiths, cultures, and races that share common threads, values, and love of service. In the National Guard, we continually strive to enlist men and women of all backgrounds. Our goal, to reflect Minnesota's diverse population in our ranks, is ever present. This is Black History Month. It's time for us to reflect and to celebrate those that paved the way toward diversity. A time to remember the Black service members who stepped forward willingly to serve our country, to fight for our flag, even though our country wasn't willing to defend their rights. This is a time to appreciate diversity today. Thank you for listening. Today's veterans are talented, team-oriented, and technologically savvy. Help good business get better by hiring today's veterans.
Thank you, General Nash. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Joining us today is John Hubble, who is the author of POW, published in 1976 by the Reader's Digest Association, which is a definitive history of the American prisoner of war experience in Vietnam from 1964 to 1973. This is a powerful and searing account of courage, heroism, and ingenuity in the face of terrifying multiple tortures, starvation, and incredible loneliness in one of the most complete accounts of the ordeal of the American prisoners of war in Vietnam. In vivid and agonizingly memorable scenes, the reader witnesses the capture of POWs. They're being paraded through the streets of Hanoi past screaming, threatening mobs, their futile attempts at escape, their continued efforts, despite repeated punishment, to communicate with each other and to maintain discipline, to retain their honor and human dignity, and their staggering ability to withstand physical and psychological torture and pain. Above all, this is an inspiring book about people in adversity, a testimony to one man's support for another, and each one's dedication to a larger ideal, his country. Before writing the book, Reader's Digest roving editor John G. Hubble directed a research team that interviewed more than 120 former prisoners of war and spent over 2 years putting their stories together. Mr. Hubble, one of the nation's most respected writers in the field of military affairs. John, welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
John, can you believe it's been 40 years, February 12th?
No, I can't believe that. It's incredible.
February 12th, 1973 was the first plane of our Vietnam prisoners of war returned to the States.
I remember watching them come off the aircraft at Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines, and I remember being astounded that they all looked like they all had big smiles on their faces, and they all looked healthy. And I'm thinking, my God, these guys have been, some of them have been gone for 9 years, and they looked like they'd been having a good time. I couldn't believe what I was seeing.
And your editor at Reader's Digest at that time gave you a marvelous assignment. He said, go out and talk to as many of those POWs as you can, do whatever you have to do, go get the story.
That's what happened, yeah. We wanted a narrative history of the whole POW experience. We didn't know what it was.
And how long did it take, John?
Well, in total, it took about 3 years, and I started out by going to Admiral Tom Moore, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs. then, and I'd interviewed him a number of times, and so I knew him. And he had an aide, Captain Jack McKercher, who was he put in charge of the whole POW homecoming thing. And Jack McKercher was an old friend of mine because we'd been on a lot of different journalistic adventures together. And so I said, "Well, let's. Why don't we start out with the people who are known to have been the leaders in the POW camps, and let them direct us to the people that they think we should talk to, and then those people can direct us to others." And that's the path we followed.
We're speaking with John Hubble, the author of POW on Minnesota Military Radio. John, who was the first one? Did you start with Admiral Denton?
Started with Jerry Denton. He was a captain then, and pretty soon he was a rear admiral. Not long after that, he was a senator from Alabama.
And what did you learn from the admiral?
That he had been suffered the tortures of the damned, that even though he had a big smile on his face and made a moving speech when he got off the plane at Clark in the Philippines, he had undergone some pretty rough treatment. And so we got him to tell me all about it, and that's what I wrote.
And over again, you heard stories of torture and suffering.
After Denton and I got through talking, I got on the phone to a fellow named Rod Knutson. He was at the Oak Knoll Naval Hospital in Oakland, California, and I flew out to California and interviewed Knutson. He was the first POW who was tortured. There had been POWs in the camp before Knutson, but he was the first one that they inflicted torture on, and he gave me chapter and verse on that.
And you also found out that there was tremendous support from one POW to another, and they were organized and under command, weren't they?
They survived for that reason. They were supporting each other, and it was like a military organization. They were governed, and they followed orders, and they cooperated.
And they told you how they communicated via something called the tap code.
By the tap code, that's right.
Can you explain that to me?
I wish I could. It's been a long time since I wrote about it. It's a block of letters, and A, B, C, D, E across, and then A and whatever goes down, and you tap the numbers and put them all together, and it spells words out.
And, of course, the North Vietnamese didn't want them communicating in any way, shape, or form.
No, they'd catch them communicating, they'd torture them. They'd put them in ropes.
And you personally, how many interviews do you think you had?
I think I had, I'm thinking for 45 or 50.
How did that affect you as a person, as a man, John?
I don't know. It made me feel pretty good to be an American. I think every one of these fellows that I talked to, I would say, I don't know. I don't think I could have done that. Put up with taking the torture that you took. And the answer I got in every instance was, you look like a pretty good American boy, and an American boy does what he has to do when the time comes.
And they were all very, very loyal and very proud, weren't
they? Yes.
And you had a lot of respect for these men, and you made some pretty good friendships.
I did, yeah.
And they last to today.
Some do, yes. I'm still friendly with John McCain. I'm still friendly with Dick Ballstead. I met Dave Wheat a couple of summers ago when Dick Ballstead had a reception for his friends out at the Officers Club in Minneapolis. But all of us have gotten a lot older. We don't stay in touch the way we used to.
I suppose things change.
Yeah.
A lot of these POWs were imprisoned or in the prison camps for many, many years, weren't they?
Yeah. Alvarez, he was from Salinas, California. He was there for 9 years. He was the first shoot down.
And I think you told me when they came off the plane in order of their captivity, didn't
they?
That's
right. That's what happened. One of the leaders was a Navy guy named Jim Stockdale, and his wife, Sybil, had organized and led the MIA POW movement in the United States. She was a go-getter. She got things organized, and she made things happen. And I remember her coming out of a meeting at the White House with President Nixon and Henry Kissinger, and I caught a glimpse of, I didn't see Nixon, but I saw Kissinger, and he was red-faced, and she looked satisfied.
John, we're going to have to take a short break. We want to continue our discussion of this anniversary, the 40-year anniversary of the return of our Vietnam POWs. When we come back, we're going to interview a Twin Cities Air Force officer who was a POW, Jerry Driscoll. So we have to take a short break. Please stay with us. This is Minnesota Military Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. I've been joined by John Hubble, who is the author of POW, published in 1976 by the Reader's Digest, the story of the Vietnam American prisoner of war experience in Vietnam. And John, we're joined now by Colonel Jerry Driscoll, who was a POW in Vietnam. Colonel Driscoll, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Yes, thank you.
How are you today, sir?
I'm fine, thank you.
Colonel, can you tell us, I understand that you were captured in 1966?
Yes, 24th of April, 1966. I was a first lieutenant and came out as a very senior captain. A year later, I was a major, and I made everything on time.
And so that was a pretty bad day in your life, wasn't it?
the 24th of April, 66, I was the fifth of five from my base, and the second one in my squadron, and only two of the five of us survived, Charlie Boyd, who was the first one, and I was the last one, and we ended up being each other's first roommates.
Can you tell us how you were shot down, sir?
As I've told other audiences, I was number four in the second flight of four thuds, the popular name for the 105, with the third flight of four from the other squadron behind us. And over the radio, I could hear my squadron commander being shot down, and he did not make it, Bill Cooper. And then I saw some gray puffs in front of me to the side. I looked down and left. Looked on the engine instruments, I saw nothing. I looked over the left canopy rails, and I was looking down the gun barrels of a 37 or 57 millimeter AAA sight. I was only doing about 1,000 feet, and I was told 450. I thought 450. My flight commander, who heard my story, says, "What do you mean 450?" He said, "Drive 550, which is about 600 miles an hour." And then about 15 or 20 seconds later, I heard over the radio, my number three man said, "Pecan 4, you're on fire." And I looked on over the instruments, and I saw a red blinking overheat light. And shortly thereafter, the airplane started to roll. I knew I didn't have hydraulics. And as the airplane rolled inverted, I reached for the ejection handles. And to this day, we're talking 1966, the present, I have no recollection of getting out of the aircraft. I must have lifted the handles, and I squeezed to one or both of the triggers, and then the seat goes a second after that, and I was on a webbing, and I was separated from the seat, and fortunately for me, I had the zero delay connected, because I estimate maybe I got two swings in the chute, I don't know, and I realized, my God, here I am. I was still in a sitting position, thinking I'm still in the airplane. And I look back, and I think, maybe I'm still in the airplane, but I pull back, and I see my parachute coming down in a rice paddy with a couple of panels blown out, and I realize, my God, here I am. So I hit the disconnect, get rid of the canopy, stood up, took off my parachute harnesses, was in the process of unzipping my G-suit when I was captured. The people that captured me were mostly farmers and a few militiamen who had about the only real weapons I really saw, which is some old rifles, probably from Dien Bien Phu, and they had big stickers, not bayonets on them. And I was captured. So there I am.
No chance to escape or evade in that?
Oh, absolutely none. I was within a 50-mile radius, which was the ROE rules of engagement, and I knew I had to get outside of that before they could even come in to get me. And I knew there was no chance that I'd be rescued, and especially after I was captured very shortly thereafter.
Colonel, and you returned home on February 12th, 1973, 40 years
ago. We're coming up on 40 years. I was in the first group that got released because of my shoot-down date.
7 long years in captivity. How bad was it, sir?
Well, I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. The food got a little bit better after Ho Chi Minh was declared dead a couple days afterwards. And with the torture stopped, and the treatment got better. And then, of course, everything got really, really good because the Paris Peace Agreement got signed on the 27th of January, 73. And I was in the first group that got released, so after they're sick and injured.
Driscoll, this is John Hubble. Are you, when you landed, after you ejected, were you injured? Did you have any broken bones?
I was very fortunate. I'm one of the few 105 drivers. My helmet was gone because my visor was up because I was below an undercast. And I think because as soon as I hit the wind stream, the wind just, the speed of the aircraft literally ripped the helmet off my head. My right glove was gone. My right sleeve was shredded all the way up to the seam on the shoulder. Had a half a dozen or so cuts on my right arm because I wasn't receiving any medical treatment, and I became infected, and I didn't receive any medical treatment for the first couple of months. And I had a whiplash injury, a twisted knee, a sprained ankle, and I was in a state of shock, and I hurt like hell for a couple months.
But no broken bones.
No broken bones. I was very fortunate. Thank
now, were you taken immediately to Hanoi?
I was, that night I was in Hanoi getting the crap beat out of me.
Huh. And how long before you were in Hanoi?
I was in that night. I got shot down in the afternoon. And that night it was already dark, and I got turned over to the military, and I was in a flatbed truck, which was not covered. It was, my hands tied behind my back and blindfolded. I've been cold and wet and because there had been some rain, and that night I was in Hanoi, in the famous Hanoi Hilton.
We're speaking with retired Colonel Jerry Driscoll and John Hubble on Minnesota Military Radio. Jerry, in John's book, he describes what he calls the Hanoi Parade. Were you one of the POWs that were taken downtown?
I was an active participant in Hanoi Street, what we call the Hanoi Street March. that was the prelude to trials which never came off because I think the Hanoi Street March was the media disaster for the North Vietnamese because I heard that Lyndon Johnson called up Ho Chi Minh and said this will cease to be a gentleman's war, and the trials never came off.
Colonel, John has also written about the fact that within the camps, within the prison camps, there was a chain of command, and there was support between the POWs, and you used the TAP code. How organized were you, and how much support were you able to give each other?
Well, we kept the rank we had when we were shot down, even though guys knew that they'd been promoted, like Robbie Reisner knew he'd made colonel, even though he shot down as an 05. And he was the leader of the camp because he was the ranking 05 until John Flynn showed up a couple of years later, and he was 06. And he was shot down as an 06, and he became the SRO, the senior ranking officer, for our organization. So I was a first lieutenant, so I had a chain of command who, even though there were guys that were shot down about a year after me, this guy Wally Newcomb, who was a captain, and he was below me ROTC-wise, even though I was an academy graduate. He was in a one class behind me in T-37s, so I knew I outranked him as a first lieutenant. But he was the captain, so he outranked me the entire time I was a POW. And then when we stepped off the airplane, I outranked him because I had data rank on him as a captain.
Colonel, we just got about a minute left, but how important was your training before you were shot down? You must have...
As far as I'm concerned, my training at STED, which was the survival school at that time until 66 when it was moved to Fairchild, as far as I'm concerned, and I literally would tell the students, because I was a squadron commander at the Air Force Survival School at Fairchild, that survival school, as far as I'm concerned, literally saved my life. Because at that time we only had the North Korea, the China experience for communist captors at that time.
Colonel, we have one thing in common. I went through the STED Survival School way back in the early 50s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I went through after graduated from pilot training in 64. November, just before Thanksgiving of 64. And you know, they closed the school two years later, and they moved it to Fairchild, which is where it is right now.
Well, I survived, and so did you, so I guess it worked.
Gentlemen, we have to take another short break. When we come back, we'll be joined by retired General John Vesey, the 10th Chairman of the Joint Staff. This is Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. In a moment, we'll be joined by retired General John Vesey to talk about his assignment to work on the Vietnam veteran POWs and MIAs. But first, it's time for the Commissioner's Corner, a weekly message from the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now here's Larry Shalito.
We honor the commitment and sacrifices made by our nation's prisoners of war. We take time to remember and pay the respect of the 1,000 men and women who have served in the military and through circumstances of war beyond their control have been held captive by enemy forces. All the way back to the Revolutionary War through current conflicts, prisoners of war have bravely endured the loss of the very freedom they fought to defend at the hands of their captors. These brave individuals deserve the recognition from their fellow citizens and have earned the right to wear their badge of courage with pride.
Thank you, Commissioner Shalito. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Joining us now is retired General John Vesey, the 10th Chairman of the Joint Chiefs on Minnesota Military Radio. General Vesey, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
Sir, I understand that in 1987, President Ronald Reagan appointed you as his presidential emissary to Hanoi.
He did indeed.
And can you share with us, sir, what your mission was? I understand it was supposed to be about a six-month job, and it turned out it lasted a little longer.
A little bit. 6 years, actually. His first and highest priority was to find out if there were any living Americans still being held by the Vietnamese, and if so, to get them out. And the second priority was to set up a system for accounting for all those Americans still unaccounted for, at least those that we could possibly account for, recognizing that in 1973, when the prisoners came back, there were about 2,600 unaccounted for. About 1,100 of those were considered killed in action and body not recovered. About 100 were thought to be prisoners of war, and the rest were simply missing in action. So the president wanted to set up an organized system to account for the missing in action after we determined whether or not there were any live Americans there. Then he had some other tasks that he wanted me to accomplish. One was to get the former South Vietnamese military officers and civilian leaders out of the prison camps. They'd been in, by this time the war had been over for 8 years, and about 8,000 of them were still held in prison camps. He also wanted to set up a system so that the hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese families that were divided, with part of the family still in Vietnam and the others in this country or in Europe, could be reunited peacefully. Then he wanted me to get the Amerasian children out of Vietnam, those children that had been fathered by American servicemen and who were looked down upon in their country. And finally wanted me to push the Vietnamese to get out of Cambodia. They were occupying Cambodia at that time.
Quite a task, sir. We're speaking with retired General John Vesey, the 10th Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, on Minnesota Military Radio. General, how were you received by Hanoi?
Well, they didn't trust us at that time, and we didn't trust them. But there were people in the Vietnamese government who recognized that their only hope of getting along with the rest of the world was to settle their differences with the United States. A fellow named Nguyen Co Thaich was then the vice prime minister and the minister of foreign affairs, and he understood this very well and wanted to get things moving. But it was, I'm convinced it was difficult for him inside his own government to do that, and he was eventually dismissed, I believe, for failing to get normal relations with the United States in a reasonable time.
General, you had served in Vietnam. I'm imagining that you had to travel to Hanoi to accomplish this task given to you by Ronald Reagan. How was it going back?
Well, it was strange. indeed strange. And, of course, Vietnam was not doing well financially in those days. They were still under strict communist economic rules. And even though the country had long been an exporter of rice, rice was still rationed in the country. The place was a mess, to tell you the truth.
Sir, I understand that you were, this mission was renewed by both the first President Bush and President Clinton. You must have been wearing down the Vietnamese getting some answers.
Well, once we found some common ground, we began to make slow but steady progress. And of course, it was a big political issue in that country, in Vietnam, and it was a big political issue in this country. When by 19, I guess it was late 73, when President Clinton lifted the trade embargo, even though it was supported by a number of senators, including John McCain, who was himself an ex-prisoner of war. It was opposed by 38 senators. It wasn't well received in this country, but eventually cooperation continued to increase, and it goes on today. We have regular operations in Vietnam looking for the remains of those missing in action.
Sir, as a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, this seems like it was a mission of honor for you.
Well, it was. These people were my friends and my comrades. John McCain's father was my boss when I was involved in the war in Laos. Mickey Wiesner's son was one of those unaccounted for, and he was a comrade of mine and a naval commander of the Pacific Command when I commanded the forces in Korea. So there were people that I knew that were missing in action, and it was important for me to be involved in the project. And, of course, we had a lot of wonderful American soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who worked in the Joint Casualty Resolution Center and continue to do that today.
So the mission isn't over. We're still looking for those that are still missing in action.
That's correct. It goes on today, but much has been done. We're down now to, I think, around 1,500 still unaccounted for, which means that we've recovered about 1,000 remains, or at least 900 remains. And, of course, when you look at the fact that there are still 73,000 missing in action from World War II and 7,500 from the Korean War, the Vietnam vets have had their work pursued by the various administrations, very diligently.
Sir, as a Vietnam veteran myself, I'd like to thank you for all your hard work trying to track down our POWs and KIAs and MIAs. What a wonderful job you did.
Well, your thanks really ought to go to the rest of those people, the intelligence people, the people in the Joint Casualty Resolution Center who do the real hard field work in this job and continue to do it today.
Well, we can never give up. That's the inspiration from the Vietnam veterans, right. Isn't it, sir?
We don't do it. We pick up our wounded and pick up our dead and get our prisoners back.
We have to take a short break. Please stay with us on Minnesota Military Radio. We'll be right back to talk more about the 40th anniversary of the return of our Vietnam POWs. Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. We've been joined in studio today by General John Vesey, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and John Hubble, the author of POW, published in 1976 by Reader's Digest. And we have a special guest, retired Air Force Colonel Jerry Driscoll, who was a POW in Vietnam. Following the Paris Peace Accords in 1973, 591 American prisoners of war were returned during Operation Homecoming. The U.S. listed about 1,350 Americans as prisoners of war or missing in action, and roughly 1,200 Americans reported killed in action and body not recovered. In general, you spent that 6 months turned into 6 years. You spent a long time trying to find everyone you could, but it's almost an impossible job to complete, isn't it, sir?
Indeed. It's, you know, you're trying to prove a negative, which is something you can't do. We won't give up hope, but we continued to look.
It's hard to believe that it's been 40 years since that first plane load of Vietnam POWs returned, isn't it?
It is. And we're all a lot older, I think, right now.
Yes, sir.
One of the things I want to do is correct what I said earlier. I said the trade embargo was lifted in 1973. It was actually 1993 that President Clinton lifted the trade embargo. So a 20-year mistake is not bad for an old guy, I guess.
Well, generals are entitled to do what they need to do, sir.
Not make big mistakes.
Mr. Hubble, one of your observations was that when you were interviewing all of these returned POWs, they were really in pretty good shape, is what you were telling us.
They seemed to be. They all seemed to be in pretty good physical condition. They weren't in as good condition as they appeared to be in many cases. A lot of them spent a long time in medical situations recovering from the treatment that they received in prison camps in Vietnam. I wanted to ask Colonel Driscoll, Colonel, how many times were you subjected to torture? Did you ever count them up?
I never did count them up. There were enough times. I have permanent reminders on my wrists of the handcuffs, which were applied in September of 66 from torture. Do you get a war crimes confession from me? I lasted about a week.
Were you ever trotted out in front of any of these visiting American anti-war groups?
No. Contrary to what has been seen on the internet, I never met Jane Fonda, and neither did Larry Kerrigan, and I never passed any note. I never was beaten, and I lost eyesight in my one eye, because if I did, I was able to fool the Air Force flight surgeons the whole time I was on flying status. And I flew for American Airlines, retired as a 727 captain, and I flew for NetJets company for almost 10 years. So I was on flying status the whole time, and my eyesight was not a problem.
Colonel General Vesey went through a painstaking process of trying to make sure all the POWs returned and then tracking down the MIAs and KIAs. Were there ever any POWs that you remember seeing that didn't come home?
As far as I know, no. And I was asked that a number of times during my talks that, if I thought that there were anybody left. My response was, no, I didn't think so, but don't ever give up hope. And we've had so many reported sightings from boat people and from others who were there, for individuals who were there in the early years after our release, that they saw people who were not Oriental, who were obviously not Oriental, and they could have been Caucasians who were under armed guard or something like that, that they could have been POWs. And we know from history that The communists did that with the French after the fall of Dien Bien Phu, and the French apparently paid a ransom or something like that. And about a year or so later, or a month or two later, oh look what we found in the next valley, and the French got their soldiers back. But that never happened to us. I think the North Vietnamese might have had the same ideas with us, but we're not the French.
We're speaking with retired General John Vesey, Colonel Jerry Driscoll, and John Hubble, author of POW on Minnesota Military Radio. General Vesey, sounds like our POWs took great advantage of the training they were provided before they went to Vietnam.
Indeed, and that, as Colonel Driscoll said, that training kept him alive. After the Korean War, the United States military recognized that it had not trained its soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines well for captivity if they were captured. And that's when the survival schools got a lot more serious and a lot better at the training. And certainly the heroism and dignity for the United States that our prisoners in Vietnam demonstrated proved the wealth of that training.
General, you must have heard a lot of the reports from the POWs after they returned and the conditions they underwent and the things that happened. And some of that must have been on your mind when you went to Hanoi and were trying to track down the rest of our missing.
Yes, indeed. And certainly, as Colonel Driscoll said, he didn't see anybody that didn't come home. And we had a case of about at least 100, and we actually raised the number to nearly 200. That we call discrepancy cases, people that we had evidence were seen alive or likely to be alive and in the hands of the Vietnamese. For example, we had pictures from the front page of the Hanoi newspaper with Americans properly identified and clearly alive and clearly in the hands of the Vietnamese who did not come home. And those were the ones we spent an awful lot of time negotiating on. And I mentioned Nguyen Co Thich earlier, and I presented this evidence to him, and he recognized that we needed to resolve those cases. And we set up a system for the United States bringing all it knew about that particular person and the Vietnamese bringing what they said was all they knew about that person. And then starting out from there and looking to see what happened to that person. And we finally resolved nearly all those cases, and it was clear that the serviceman had not survived.
Mr. Hubble, we're nearly out of time. Your book is compelling reading, especially for a Vietnam veteran. Is it still available?
It's still available, but you have to order it from a company that prints it on demand. You have to ask for it.
The name of the company?
Name of the company is iUniverse, and they're located in Bloomington, Indiana.
Thank you, sir. Colonel Driscoll, we're just about out of time. Any final thoughts for our listeners?
No, I don't think so. I do have a copy of Mr. Hubble's book, and it's quite well documented for all of us that got released.
Colonel, thank you for joining us today. General Vesey, 40 years have gone by. I don't know where they went. But I'm certainly glad we got our POWs home, and I, for one, am very happy that you went through that painstaking process to try to track down the rest.
Well, it was a pleasure to be with you, Tom, and a pleasure to be with Mr. Hubble and with Colonel Driscoll today and hear what they had to say.
General, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
It was General John Vesey, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Colonel Jerry Driscoll, a POW in Vietnam, and John Hubble, the author of POW, published in 1976 by Reader's Digest. We're just about out of time. If you have a mailbag question or a suggestion for a topic you'd like us to address, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com and click on Contact Us to send us a note. Thanks for listening to this edition of Minnesota Military Radio. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week, John Hubble, Colonel Jerry Driscoll, General John Vesey, Commissioner Larry Shalado, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and finally, Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General Rick Nash. Please join us next week as we meet two World War II veterans who led the way for today's women in the military and get the latest from our friends at the Marine Corps League. That's coming up next weekend on this station or online anytime at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week.
You've been listening to Minnesota Military Radio with Tom Lyons. Tom is the founder and owner of Phalon Partners Limited, a Twin Cities merger and acquisition firm. This has been a production of Clear Channel, MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com, the Minnesota National Guard, BeyondTheYellowRibbon.org, and the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Podcasts of the show are available at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com.